The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, our journey is going to take us to a place under the long shadow of war. This is the title for the article written by Robert Draper, appearing in the May 2023 issue of National Geographic. Now, before we read Robert's story, I want to provide some background to give you a clear picture of what's happening in a country many of us once knew as Yugoslavia. Now, this story comes from the Associated Press. Diplomatic spat erupts between Balkan rivals Serbia, Croatia. This was written by Giovanna Geck and published on July 17, 2022, and it was Dateline Belgrade, Serbia. So here we go. Diplomatic tensions soared Sunday, that would be July 17, 2022, between Balkan rivals Serbia and Croatia, after Croatia refused to allow a private visit by Serbia's populist president to the site of a World War II concentration camp where tens of thousands of Serbs were killed by pro-Nazi authorities in Croatia. Croatia's authorities said they learned about the planned visit to the Jasanovic camp by Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić through unofficial channels. Foreign Minister Gordon Grlić Radman told reporters that the fact that the Croatian government had not been formally notified of the visit was unacceptable. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs would like to stress that in the planning of any visit by foreign officials, the time, nature, and the program of the visit should be subject to an official communication with agreement by both sides, says Grlić Radman. This was not a trip to the seaside. The president of the country is a protected individual. Croatia's decision sparked outrage in neighboring Serbia, where officials described it as scandalous. Serbia's hardline interior minister, Aleksandar Vulin, said all Croatian officials from now on would have to announce any transit or visit to Serbia and would be placed under special regime of control. He did not elaborate. This was an anti-European, anti-civilization decision and brutal violation of the freedom of movement, Serbian Prime Minister Ana Brnabic told the pro-government Pink Television. I don't know what our relations will look like in the future, she added. This is sending a frightening message. Well, relations between Serbia and Croatia have remained tense since the breakup of the former Yugoslavia and the 1991-95 war in Croatia that erupted when its Serb minority, backed by Serbia, rebelled against Croatia's independence. More than 10,000 people were killed in the war. Although the two nations have pledged to work to resolve remaining problems from the conflict, such as finding those still missing, occasional diplomatic spats have marred the post-war efforts. Serbia's populist authorities have insisted that Croatia's government has not done enough to acknowledge its World War II past, while Zagreb accuses Serbia of using the issue for internal politics and refusing to deal with its own role in the 1990s war. We see this as a provocation, Yadman said. He added, such a visit is not sincere. It is not about honoring the victims of the Jasanovic camp, where thousands of Croatian Serbs and Jews and Roma perished in brutal executions during the World War II rule of the pro-Nazi authorities. Vučić, a former ultra-nationalist who supported the Serb rebellion in Croatia in the 1990s, has scheduled a press conference, and that was held on July 18, 2022. And he responded the day before in an Instagram post featuring a photo of the Jasanovic monument. And he said, you, Croatia, just do your job. The Serbian people will live and never forget. So that gives you kind of the tone of where this article is going to be coming from. It's more recent and gives you an idea of the background of how things are in that particular region of Eastern Europe. In Kosovo, and now we begin the long shadow of war to build a vital future, Kosovo seeks to be recognized as an independent country and to resolve its conflicts with Serbia. So let's begin. In Kosovo, a very young country of war-scarred survivors, everyone has a story that is almost too painful to recount. Except here they are, alive to tell it, and insistent that the world listen. So it is that in the Parliament building in the capital city of Pristina, I step into the office of National Assembly's 36-year-old Deputy Speaker, Saranda Bushevekci, whose warm smile and firm handshake do not altogether succeed in deflecting attention from the deep, pale scars on her forearm from above her disfigured left hand. Nor does Bushevekci shy from describing the origins of those wounds. She was 13 on March 28, 1999, when a Serbian paramilitary unit descended on the town of Bojeviv, where Saranda and her family live. The soldiers herded the 21 Bojevicis into a garden, pushed them up against the wall, and opened fire. Then they departed, leaving a heap of lifeless bodies. Among them were a 2-year-old boy, the family's matriarch, and Saranda's best friend and cousin, Nora. But 5 of the 21 were still breathing, including Saranda, who somehow survived 16 bullet wounds. Bushevekci tells me she and Nora wore matching boots, and she still has hers. I learned with time that the memories are really important, and that I have to keep them, and I have to cherish them, and I have to save them, she says. Without these happier recollections, there is only damage to survey. I did not ask for the past they gave me, she says of the Serbs. Casually glancing at her left arm and hand, she adds, I have to live with it for the rest of my life. The past is just not the past. Before she died, Nora had been joyful, imagining she would be celebrating her upcoming 15th birthday in a liberated Kosovo. 4 days earlier, NATO had launched its first airstrikes, the culmination of a bloody conflict between Kosovar Albanians, like the Bojevicis and Serbs, who had controlled the territory since the end of World War II. In 1989, the Serbian government began a soft ethnic cleansing before dismissing ethnic Albanian state workers like Bojevicic's father, an electrical engineer, and forbidding ethnic Albanian children like Saranda from attending public schools. Kosovar Albanians resisted peacefully at first, but eventually waging an insurgency to seek independence. In the summer of 1998, Serbian authorities forced the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of ethnic Albanians. After NATO's intervention, they unleashed a campaign of ethnic cleansing, killing thousands of civilians and burying many in hidden mass graves. Bojevicci tells me about a group of women she met while visiting her family's gravesite in Podujeva. The women, some quite young, told Bojevicci that their families had been apprehended by Serbian authorities and never seen since. The women had gathered there, they said, because they had no memorial of their own. Families like theirs hold out hope the graves of more than 1,600 victims still missing will someday be found. Today, the Deputy Speaker of Kosovo's Parliament helps to oversee a Balkan country that a decade and a half after it declared independence from Serbia in 2008 remains beset by economic, cultural, and geopolitical challenges. Such hurdles are imposing but also surmountable. What has proved more vexing is Kosovo's yearning to be Kosovo. What Kosovo wants are things other nations have wanted and received in the past. It wants resolution of the myriad war crimes committed by Serbian forces. It wants to be acknowledged as an independent nation by the entire world. Of the 193 United Nations member states, over 100 have at one time or another recognized Kosovo as a country. Among those that do not, for geopolitical reasons of their own, are Serbia, Russia, Spain, Greece, Mexico, Argentina, South Africa, and China. Kosovo also wants to control the entirety of its territory. Serbian-majority regions in the north remain effectively governed by its neighbor, and yes, it wants self-sufficient economy, a better educational system, and greater job opportunities for its youth and women. But Albanian Kosovars insist that they cannot fully face these challenges while demons of the past loom over the country unexorcised, as Vojislav Osmani, the president of Kosovo, told me when we met in her office. For these past 20 years, the international community has asked Kosovo to just swallow the pain, not talk about the past, not talk about the crimes that were committed against us. They promised us a much better and brighter future if we only look forward and don't ever seek justice for what was done against our people. But when you don't tell the truth about your own country's history, then someone else will twist the truth. They will revise that history for their own purposes, she said. Kosovo's challenges would be formidable enough without its regional difficulties. A small country about the size of Lebanon, it is a landlocked, diamond-shaped territory bordered by larger countries, Serbia, North Macedonia, Albania, and Montenegro. Though Kosovo's status as having the youngest population in Europe augurs a promising future, at present its unemployment rate is the highest on the continent, and its economy has a negative balance of trade. To be sure, the infant country has made progress. When NATO troops landed in Kosovo in June 1999, one of the eyewitnesses to the country's liberation from Serbian control was an 18-year-old war refugee named Vlora Sitiku, who served as an interpreter for the international media. 9 years later, after serving in Parliament, as Sitiku tells it, I literally was handed a piece of paper and told, "You're deputy foreign minister." I literally had nothing. No computer, no staff, no office. There was no foreign ministry. We had to build everything from scratch. In 2015, Sitiku became Kosovo's ambassador to the United States, a witty, stylish, and driven diplomat who spent her 5 years in Washington seeking to impress upon the Obama and Trump administrations that Kosovo should be regarded by the allies who midwifed it into being as unfinished business, a country not yet fully capable of charting its own destiny. At the time that Kosovo formally declared its independence, its government operating budget was just $933 million. Today, that figure has quadrupled. Still, the government's grip on its sovereignty remains precarious. Among Kosovo's 38 municipalities, 10 are under some form of Serbian control, with mayors who are widely seen as proxies for the neighboring government. The capital city of Pristina is urbane and European, its cafes teeming at all hours. But a little more than 6 miles away lies Gračanica, now seemingly in another country altogether, where the common currency is not the euro but the Serbian dinar. The town centerpiece is a magnificent 700-year-old Serbian Orthodox church, a short walk from a statue commemorating a 14th-century Serbian hero, a knight named Miloš Obilić. Now, Serbian flags predominate as well along the road to the border town of Zubin Potok, a thoroughfare that is sometimes barricaded by Serbian forces several miles inside Kosovo. To be a citizen of a country like Kosovo that is not universally recognized means an inability to travel freely, even to other European countries, without a special visa. But Kosovo's fraught relations with Serbia hamper its progress in more insidious ways. As Barat Rukiki, the president of Kosovo's Chamber of Commerce, explains to me, the key for investors is predictability, which is related to political risk. Here we fail, because for them, Kosovo is an unfinished story. The story is Kosovo belongs to Serbia. As Sitiku puts it, why would someone serious come and invest in a no-man's land? Kosovo, for me, it is a state. But if you Google it, it is a contested territory. And each time we tried to privatize a company, and each time a bidder would come in, 2 days later they would receive a note from Serbia saying, "We will sue you if you buy the property because it's ours." It complicates the business climate, the former ambassador said. It complicates the political climate. It complicates everything. To learn more about the region's tumultuous history, I went to Gazmenistan, a memorial near Pristina commemorating the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. A security guard and his two dogs greeted us. No one else was there to view the structure. Built in 1953 to look like a medieval tower, it rises above an otherwise vacant field. When I commented jokingly to the guard that he was lucky to have the dogs to keep him company, he assured me that it was crowded on holidays when busloads of tourists drove in from Serbia to pay homage. The monument, designed by a Serbian architect, is dedicated to the enduring significance of Serbian martyrdom. Serbia's identity of valor and sacrifice is as bound up in the Battle of Kosovo as it is in Texas with the Battle of the Alamo. The oddity of the bloody one-day battle is that the losing effort against the Ottoman Empire troops was waged not just by Serbs, but also by a coalition that included Bulgarians, Albanians, and several other Christian nationalities. Furthermore, the singular significance of the Battle of Kosovo to the Serbian population did not take on such intense geopolitical overtones until June 28, 1989, when Serbia's president, Slobodan Milosevic, stood before the Gatsminasin monument and declared, "The Kosovo heroism has been inspiring our creativity for six centuries and has been feeding our pride and does not allow us to forget that at one time we were an army great, brave, and proud, one of the few that remained undefeated when losing. Kosovo's centrality to the Serbian collective consciousness has remained fixed ever since." Indeed, on the way from Belgrade's airport to my hotel in the regal capital city, among my first night sights, weather was graffiti in an overpass that read, "Kosovo is Serbia." The complication with this Serbian narrative then and now is that Kosovo was and is populated overwhelmingly by ethnic Albanians. Their distinct language, culture, and Islamic faith make them an awkward fit in the otherwise Slavic and largely Christian composition of Yugoslavia during its communist years. In the beginning of that era, it wasn't so important whether you were Serb or Albanian, says Bojan Pokovic, a director of the National Museum in Belgrade, and by the end, it was the only thing that mattered. Milosevic's speech at Gatsminasin inaugurated a decade-long effort to impose a Serbian identity on the Kosovo population by force. Albanian language newspapers were shut down, municipal governments dissolved, and ethnic Albanians banished from civic life. "I grew up with Serbian employees coming to our house, destroying everything," Vasej Krasniki Goodman, a 39-year-old woman with elegantly angular Balkan features, told me one evening while wearily smoking a cigarette in a Pristina restaurant. The authorities, she recalled, were looking for her father, whom they suspected of having an unlicensed gun, and for her brother, who had gone AWOL from the army. In April 1999, when she was 16, the Serbs came for her. Two men, one a police officer, raped her, first in the back of a car and then in an empty house. She and her family fled to the mountains, but even after NATO liberated Kosovo, the girl felt marked by what had happened to her. She married a UN peacekeeper and returned with him to Arkansas. She had two children, divorced, moved to Dallas, and while waiting tables met a shy engineer named Sean Goodman, who had no idea where Kosovo was, much less what a young woman like her would have experienced there. They married, and still the past remained with her, and she decided to embrace that reality. In 2018, she returned to Pristina and appeared before a nationally televised audience. Though it was well known that some 20,000 ethnic Albanians, most but not all of them women, had been sexually assaulted during the war, no survivors had openly told their story in a public forum until then. Vasfiji Grasniki Goodman became widely recognized in Kosovo. 2 years later, she ran for parliament. At home in Texas, she learned she'd won. A medical condition that made international travel unbearable would force Grasniki to vacate her seat 19 months later. But as a lawmaker, she had assigned herself an unusual, though fitting, portfolio. "I meet with survivors," she told me while she was still in parliament. "It's one of the most important things I do." Since the Kosovo government did not have the resources to provide her with an office, she would meet with them in coffee shops and listen to their stories. Their refrain was hauntingly familiar. All of them, she said, then amended herself, we want justice. The odds of that are bleak, as Krasniki Goodman well knows. Many Serbians suspected of war crimes, including some prominent officials, have never been prosecuted. Milosevic was tried by a UN tribunal for war crimes, but in 2006 he died of a heart attack in a prison cell before the trial's conclusion. One of the killers of Vukcevic's family was sentenced to 20 years, but was let out several years early for good behavior, only to be arrested later for running a drug cartel. Krasniki Goodman's attackers were convicted, but the verdicts were later overturned. In June 2021, Nedic Kenak, a former member of the Serbian National Assembly and now an opposition party leader, crossed the border to meet with Kosovo Prime Minister Albin Kurti. What Kenak also did across the border would arouse more controversy back home than his dialogue with the hated Kurti. He visited the village of Meji and laid flowers on the site where in 1999 Serbian soldiers and police massacred more than 370 Kosovar Albanians, transported their bodies to the Belgrade suburb of Batajnica, and buried them en masse. "I saw these things with my own eyes," Kenak said when we met in his office in Novi Sad, Serbia's second-largest city. He said dryly, "Now we have this peculiar situation. If you don't believe the Serbian government, but instead believe your own eyes, you're a national traitor." I tried unsuccessfully to secure permission to visit the Batajnica site, which was discovered in 2001 on the grounds of a Serbian police compound. The fact that the Serbian government refuses to allow unfettered access or publicly mark the great mass graves tends to complicate the country's assertion that it has turned the page from the belligerence of the Milosevic era. Its president, Aleksandar Vucic, was Milosevic's propaganda minister, and in 2018 hailed the former president as a great Serbian leader. Its first deputy prime minister, Ivica Dacic, was Milosevic's spokesman. More insidiously, the current unofficial Serbian policy, known as passivation of residential addresses, in which authorities have reportedly forced thousands of Albanian residents to leave Serbia after being unable to show their registration records on demand, would seem to resemble, as the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights in Serbia put it in a scathing report, a form of ethnic cleansing through administrative means. It happens that both Serbia and Kosovo wish to enter the European Union, but neither can do so without a normalization accord. Despite years of talks, such an eventuality seems light years away. While in Belgrade, I met with Dusan Milakovic, a political consultant. He told me, "The NATO bombing remains the most important event for the Serbian people. The damage done by the shelling was above all psychologically explained, because the Serbs were proud people who had fought on the right side during the world wars, a legacy now buried under a global narrative that casts Serbs as villains. This creates a kind of defensive position that can distort the national mind," Milonikovic said, adding that most Serbs were eager to normalize relations, but not if it required further wallowing in the past. "The Kosovo government is pushing the narrative of accountability," he added. "If there's ever an agreement, that'll have to fall off the table." The stalemate between the countries sparks flare-ups with alarming regularity. During my 3 weeks in the region in late 2021, the Kosovo government retaliated against the long-standing Serbian policy of not permitting cars bearing Kosovo license plates to come into the country, since this would amount to a de facto recognition of the latter's sovereignty. Suddenly, it was decreed Serbian-plated cars could not enter Kosovo either. The license plate imbroglio meant that my Serbian driver had to let me out 100 yards from the border checkpoint, which I had to walk through to meet a Kosovar driver waiting to ferry me to Pristina. Nearly a year later, in September 2022, Kosovo's government, added a new wrinkle. Its resident Serbs, less than 5% of the population, would have to forsake their Serbian license plates to keep driving in Kosovo. The edict was met with vehement resistance, including barricaded streets, before international pressure compared Kosovo officials 2 months later to turn down the temperature by simply issuing warnings to drivers. Even so, Vucic ordered Serbian troops to the border. In December, the Serbian leader, responding to pressure from the West, persuaded protesters to remove the barricades. The many Kosovars with whom I spoke seem well aware that the outside world views the ongoing Kosovo-Serbia impasse warily. That apprehensiveness certainly extends to America, which was instrumental in Kosovo's liberation. The latter country's appreciation for the former is obvious to anyone who strolls through Pristina and sees the statues of Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and Bob Dole. Still, that Kosovo is in every meaningful way dependent on the U.S. government, which in March 2022 announced it would commit an additional $31.9 million in assistance to the $1 billion spent in Kosovo since 1999, is a double-edged sword. Preoccupied with the war in Ukraine, U.S. policymakers do not wish to be drawn into a proxy war in the Balkans, where Serbia maintains a strong alliance with Russia. The desire not to inflame tensions has meant, for example, that Kosovo acquiesced to the Serbian government's demand that its war-era paramilitary group, the Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA, be investigated for war crimes. The country's former president, who was a KLA official, faces trial in a special court in The Hague. Last year, the court convicted the former KLA commander. Still, an ethos of self-determined resilience pervades the 15-year-old country. Its parliament, after all, includes Saranda Bukovici, a survivor of unfathomable violence. Its president, Vosha Osmani, was marched at gunpoint across the border to Albania as a teenage girl. A former president, Afete Zhahega, now head of a pro-democracy NGO, spent 5 months hiding in a darkened Pristina apartment before NATO troops freed her and her family. Its prime minister, Albin Kurti, was confined with 30 other men in a tiny cell before being dragged out and used as a human shield during the NATO bombardment. In Kosovo, the survivors are now the leaders. They have not succumbed to their wounds. Of all the inspiring figures I met in Kosovo, the most unassuming was Fahaji Hati, a 52-year-old businesswoman with keen eyes and a preoccupied air. She lives in the agricultural village of Krushe Demati, a peaceful place until the Milosevic era, when, as she told me, every morning we would wake up and say, "Whose turn is it to get arrested or killed today?" Before dawn on March 25, 1999, Serbian tanks advanced on the village. Hati returned her husband to run, or urged her husband, rather, to run, and she fled with the two children to the forest. They returned the next day to find that Serbian police had taken over. The women, children, and elderly men were marched 13 miles to the city of Gajavoki, where they were told mass graves awaited them. Hati slipped away from the throng while carrying her all but lifeless infant son. She found her daughter, whose feet were caked with blood from marching on broken glass, as well as her father-in-law. They escaped to Albania, where they lived in tents with thousands of other refugees. On June 22, 1999, Hati told and her children, her father-in-law, returned to find Krushe Demati had been reduced to ashes. As the young men had disappeared, her husband's body was never found. But that is only where her story begins, for in this ghost village, Hati says, "I had to play the role of a man." More precisely, she rallied the other women to form a cooperative. First, they had an apiary. In 2005, a better idea emerged. They would buy the ubiquitous red bell peppers from farmers and make javar, a traditional sauce. Some men ridiculed her for not finding a more feminine occupation. "They just made me more determined not to stop," she recalled. Today, Hodi's company processes more than 1,300 tons of red peppers a year. She employs more than 70 women and young men, and she's still looking for her husband. She is still waiting for an apology. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.